This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John, who's on assignment in Mexico. We're going to have more from John later this week. But in this hour, we'll take you to Boston to hear about how both old and new technologies helped catch the Boston bombers. Also news about a campaign to try and limit ever more lethal and automated weapons from being used in modern warfare. But we start in Washington and the unfolding crisis at the IRS. Remember a few weeks ago, the report by the IRS Inspector General cited that a, quote, few lower-level staff members from the Cincinnati office were the ones responsible for going after those Tea Party and conservative groups and their applications. Well, here we are 2 weeks later, and NBC News says it's seen letters that show that requests about conservative groups were made by other IRS locations, not just in Cincinnati, and that those asking for this information included Lois Lerner, the woman who was in charge of the IRS unit reviewing those applications for those very conservative groups. Lois Lerner was placed on paid administrative leave as of Thursday and took the Fifth in front of a congressional committee, said she did nothing wrong. But at the same time, our partner, the New York Times, is reporting that many of the groups in question, the Tea Party groups and others, actually did engage in the very kinds of political activity that should legally have earned them that IRS scrutiny in the first place. Things are not quite what they seem on either side of the story. And that's why we want to talk to Marcus Owens. He's the former director of the IRS's Exempt Organizations Division, the very division in question. He knows as much about this division and how it operates as anyone else. Mr. Owens, thank you for being here.
You're certainly welcome.
Well, how have you been reflecting on this crisis at your old corner of the IRS? It's been a real big flare-up, and you know what it's like to be there. How has it made you feel?
Well, I'm a bit disappointed, actually, in the reaction of various governmental offices and individuals to this whole matter. Starting with the fact that the Inspector General's report, I think, was about as carelessly worded as the standards for processing applications by the Cincinnati office. And that just seems to have expanded.
At the same time, Marcus Owens, it seems like whoever made the decision, and this still seems unclear, but whoever made the decision to use keywords like Tea Party, like Patriot, et cetera, in order to discover who to give attention to was politically at least pretty ham-handed. Somebody didn't realize that this was going to look really bad.
Well, you know, it's important to remember a couple of things. One, that sort of terminology, if it was limited to those words, would be certainly ineffective in identifying the full range of organizations that would be dabbling in politics. I mean, for example, Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS doesn't use those words in the title, but nevertheless clearly was involved in political campaigns. The important thing to remember is the context in which this is occurring. The narrowness of the IG's report fails to disclose, for example, that at the same time the IRS is struggling with these applications for exemption, and it's still going on, by the way, 64 groups had identified themselves to the IRS as being political organizations and used the words Tea Party in their name. So what the IRS is dealing with is a proto-political party. It's a political party beginning to emerge, much like the cicadas are about to emerge down in Washington, D.C., where I work. But in the Inspector General's report, I don't see any evidence of illegal activity. I see evidence of poor management decisions. I see evidence of a management structure that could use some reform. I see evidence of employees grappling with very tough legal issues and having to deal with organizations that appear perfectly ready to lie under oath. And I should say lie under oath because that application for exemption is signed under penalties of perjury. So when an organization applies to the Internal Revenue Service and says it's not going to engage in political activity, at the same time, it is clearly doing so on the internet or in public space generally, there's a crime there, and that crime is intentionally misleading the Internal Revenue Service in tax administration.
And at the same time, Marcus Owens, before we let you go, isn't it clear that some people at the IRS, perhaps Lois Lerner, those below her, should have been a lot smarter about the perception here? Members of Congress were writing letters to say, my constituents, these organizations in my district, are being targeted? Can you give us more? They feel they're being targeted. Can you give us more information? People were kind of smelling a rat here, and the rat, pardon my metaphor, kind of kept running around. They didn't really rein it in, did they?
They certainly could have been better, but you need to – better choice of words. But you need to remember that there is a privacy rule in Section 6103 of the Internal Revenue Code that prevents the IRS from discussing any particular organization or individual's tax matters with anyone other than the individual, and that includes members of Congress. So there can simply be no responsive answer to a member of Congress with regard to any particular tax-exempt organization except for that information that is in the public record, which would be the approved application for exemption. And these applications were pending, so there was literally nothing the IRS could legally say.
Marcus Owens, you've spent enough time in Washington, certainly. Where do you think this is going? The GOP certainly smells a lot of blood in the water here, and they are gunning for a much bigger scandal. Do you think there's one in the offing?
I think there's this is going to be very interesting because I think the GOP is desperate to head off IRS audit activity here. There has been an awful lot of discussion. In fact, a number of investigative groups like ProPublica, Center for Public Integrity, and others, Center for Responsive Politics, have been tracking the discrepancies between what these organizations have said under oath on their applications for exemption and on their Form 990s, which is the annual information return, and comparing that with what they were actually doing at the same point in time, and finding tremendous differences there. In other words, assertions of no political activity under oath, while at the same time clear political activity is going on.
You think the bigger scandal is with the organizations themselves and not with the IRS, which is the opposite of what the GOP that is investigating this is going for?
Absolutely. The GOP wants desperately to avoid closer scrutiny, closer audit activity of these organizations. People will go to jail for that. They have recently gone to jail because of tax investigations about lying on the tax filings made with the IRS. That includes the Fiesta Bowl, and just a few months ago, a charity operated by friends of a former D.C. city council person who's it was used to funnel money to political purposes. People are going to jail for misleading the IRS about political activity involving tax-exempt organizations, and that's what the GOP wants to avoid here.
Marcus Owens is the former director of the IRS's Exempt Organizations Division, the very division that you've been reading about and hearing about in the news, the one led by Lois Lerner and the scandal involving scrutiny of Tea Party conservative groups. He says that the real scandal is in the political activity and the potential perjury of the groups themselves and not in his own division. Very interesting. Mr. Owens, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we'll come back to the subject of money and people claiming to be something different from what they really are in just a moment. But first, here's something very real. America's breadwinners. The Pew Research Center has just published a new report, and that report says that of all households with kids under 18, 40% of them include mothers who provide the sole or primary source of income for the family. Now, that is a new record, especially when you remember that in 1960, the figure was not 40%, it was 11%. Well, joining us to go over the findings and their significance, Bryce Covert, economic policy editor at Think Progress, a liberal group. Hi, Bryce.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. It strikes me at first glance that this is an effect of the recession, primarily men in the construction business, other businesses that tanked in 2009 went out of work, and that meant that their wives or other people in the household picked up the slack. Is that getting close to the target?
There's a couple of different things going on here. One of them is an ongoing trend since the 1960s and 70s of women entering the labor force in huge numbers. Women's participation is now about half. So about half of workers are now women, which is a big difference. They're also getting a lot more education, which helps increase your earnings. So all of that is helping them to earn more than they have been ever before. The other half of this trend, however, is due to a rise in single motherhood. A the majority of these women who whose families are relying on their income are actually single mothers. And that is not necessarily a story of women's economic victory, because they actually make a lot less than other households that have two earners.
So women overall are working more. Women overall are earning more. That's good. There are a lot more single mothers than there used to be, and there's been an economic collapse. Obviously, both of those not so good on the other side. It's a mixed picture. And it seems like the public's attitude, the public's comfort with the data that you're describing is mixed as well.
It is mixed. It's definitely changing. Two-thirds of Americans disagree with the idea that it's better for a husband to earn more than his wife, while about 40% agreed with that statement just 15 years ago. That's a huge change. But a lot of people feel that women's entrance into the labor force has made it harder for parents to raise children. They say it's made marriages more difficult to succeed. So I think there's a lot of ambivalence going on. The respondents to this survey are not interested in seeing women go back to the 1960s picture of Leave It to Beaver mothers waiting at home, but I also think they are concerned about what this means for raising children and what this means for two married people who have to go to the workforce every day.
And at the same time, Bryce Covert, we're in a situation, of course, a much longer trend where wages, real wages are depressed. Wages are low in relation to the buying power of American workers. And this seems to fit right into that larger trend, single mothers not being able to demand as much income in the workplace, and they're trying to get by.
Absolutely. And when it comes to single mothers, there's a lot of economic hardship that tends to fall on them. A lot of them are employed in low-wage jobs in the retail sector or the service sector that also come with very few benefits. The U.S. also just doesn't have a very good support system for single parents. It's been rated the worst country for single parents among many developed countries. We lack guaranteed paid time off when you have a new child or if your child gets sick. We have the least generous income support system. American single parents have the highest rate of lacking health insurance. So single parents really face a lot of obstacles, and I think it's not necessarily an exciting trend to see them more families relying on their income just because they're not necessarily bringing in enough, not because single motherhood has to be difficult, but because we don't make it very easy to get by.
Right. New data from Pew showing that 40% of all American households have women as the primary breadwinners. It's a brand new trend in the American economy. Bryce Covert, economic policy editor at Think Progress. Thank you.
Thank you.
Federal prosecutors have now charged seven people with running what could turn out to be the largest money laundering operation in U.S. history. The case revolves around an online payment company called Liberty Reserve, but investigators say it laundered $6 billion for criminals around the world, including drug dealers, credit card fraudsters, and child pornographers and others. The size of the operation has been described as staggering. This one online network is thought to have processed over 55 million illegal transactions for over a million users, including at least 200,000 right here in the U.S. So how do you launder $6 billion online? Jeffrey Robinson is author of The Laundrymen and is known as one of the world's leading experts on international financial crime. Jeffrey, welcome.
Nice to see you.
Thanks for joining us. And that's really the question. $6 billion in virtual money is what we're talking about. This is all online, shadow transactions of virtual money, not the kind of money laundered. This is not taking a sack of cash into the bank like in Scarface and they launder it for you.
Well, it almost is. But I mean, when you ask how do you launder $6 billion, this is exactly how you do it. Now, you have to understand there are two parts to this. The first part is what Liberty Reserve was doing, just like PayPal. They were moving money from point A to point B in blips on a computer screen. There's no actual cash transaction. I want to pay you. I get on my email account and my Liberty Reserve email account, and I say, pay Todd $6 billion, and $6 billion moves from my account to your account, and there is no record of that transaction. Suddenly, you have $6 billion in your account. But there's another stage. You actually have to buy the LRs, which is the digital cash, like Bitcoin.
Right.
So you've got to purchase those. So you go to an exchange, like the place where you see change, Bureau de Change, and that sort of thing. You go there, and you say, I'd like to buy some LRs. And these guys are licensed. Liberty Reserve was not. But these guys are licensed, and they say, okay, how much do you want? And I say, $6 billion worth, please. And you hand them $6 billion in used fivers, and they give you a credit to your email account in the name of bogusperson@lr.com, and they now have you credited with $6 billion. LR doesn't know who you are. These people don't really know who you are. They don't know what you're going to do with it. You then pay a transaction fee to move – I pay the transaction fee to move the $6 billion to you and add 75 cents. This was the amusing part of it. A 75-cent transaction fee called a privacy fee. For 75 cents extra, they will erase –
On your $6 billion,
they will erase all record of the transaction.
And so the double anonymity here is really the point, and that's what the Liberty Reserve allowed all these criminals – to have, which is anonymity with Liberty Reserve, anonymity with the exchangers, and they're just basically numbers switching money online very easy.
That's it. I mean, it's a push of a computer button and that's it, and it's done. Now, I send you the $6 billion. You want to now buy some AR-15s so that you can overthrow a South American country. So you get the arms dealer and you say, how much are the automatic weapons? And he says, $4 billion. You say, thank you very much. Ship them to this address in Panama, in the Panama Canal Zone. And you now transfer the $4 billion to him.
Right.
And no record.
And no record. And then it raises a couple of questions. With all of this anonymity, the amount of forensic work, and we're not going to be able to get into the details, but I'm reading about this and I'm listening to you talking, thinking, my gosh, how did they ever – catch these guys in the first place? I can understand general scrutiny, like, wow, this is murky. But to actually get in there and be able to find out who to arrest.
Well, the guy who started Liberty Reserve is a guy named Budovsky, who had been an American, gave up his American citizenship, became a Costa Rican of Russian origin. And he's a wanted fugitive. He was arrested in 2006, I think, 2005, for running this sort of a thing in New York. He got 5 years probation. He jumped and ran to Costa Rica. So he's a wanted fugitive. He was arrested in Spain. He's been on everybody's radar for a long time. And they've been looking at LR. What they did was an undercover sting. They got guys inside buying LRs. And they did it with names, and I said bogus. One of the undercover sting accounts he filed, he says, my name is bogus. And that's what he gave as his name.
And that was fine.
And that was fine. Nobody checked. Nobody cared.
The prosecutor in this case, you know, one wonders also, 200,000 illegitimate users right here in the U.S. laundering money. You also think they must have been mixed in with legitimate people. Bad people and good people use PayPal. And the prosecutor said, hey, if you're legit, come forward. You'll get your money back. No problem. With sort of a wink. He doesn't think anybody was really using this legitimately, were they?
No, and there probably wasn't. Because if you wanted to do it legitimately, use PayPal. I mean, if you want to buy something on eBay, you don't use a name called bogus. You use your name and you pay for it with a credit card or you pay for it with PayPal. You do whatever you have to do. And it doesn't matter if somebody can see the transaction. It's the people who don't want these transactions to be seen. For example, if you want to get on a kiddie porn site, the last thing you want to do is use your credit card because it's traceable. There's a money trail. So what you do is you go to LR and you buy some LRs and you pay the porn site with LRs and they don't know who you are. You don't have any money trail. And you can download whatever you want. Those are the people who were using LR. I would venture to say there was almost none, virtually none, no transactions that were legitimate.
The legitimate virtual currency that everybody knows about that we mentioned at the top is Bitcoin.
Yes.
And it seems to me that Bitcoin's going to get a lot more scrutiny now.
Bitcoin must be trembling in their boots right now. Because, again, there are two parts to this. One are the Bitcoin transactions, which can be transparent and may not be transparent. You can work all sorts of different ways with Bitcoin. The other thing are the dealers who are selling you the Bitcoins. So that, again, there are two parts to it. The dealers who are selling the Bitcoins have to be licensed. Bitcoin has to be licensed. And the federal government has been looking at Bitcoin very, very seriously.
And before we let you go, Jeffrey Robinson, it seems to me that the criminals who were so good at Liberty Reserve are taking lessons from this and learning new ways to launder money.
They are always two steps ahead of the government. Absolutely. But the government's getting pretty good at this. Unfortunately, so are the criminals.
Pretty good at the scrutiny.
Yeah, and the criminals are getting good at staying two steps ahead.
Jeffrey Robinson is author of The Laundryman. He is known as one of the world's leading experts on international financial crime. Now, Harold in South Florida has this to say, there are legitimate reasons to keep certain transactions secret. Buying firearms with a credit card leaves a trail. Confiscation has happened around the world many times and might happen here someday. The purchase of gold bullion should remain a secret. Forfeiture has happened before by presidential order and was never ruled unconstitutional. It could happen again. That's what Harold in South Florida has to say. Harold, thank you. There's more, as always, at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's take a couple minutes now to talk about gadgets. You know, you have them, you love them, your iPod, your can opener, that old video game system. We're going to take a few minutes and talk about the old technology that we love and some new technology that we hate to the point of banning it. That's actually going on. We asked you, what old gadgets are you still holding on to, and why do you hold on to them so tightly? Many of you wrote in praise for your old video game systems. As I mentioned, a listener from Dallas writes, I still have my Intellivision video game system along with several games. I don't know why I keep it. Maybe for sentimental reasons. It was fun and advanced when it came out. Yeah, that's the way those game systems go.
Hi, this is Morgan calling from South Carolina. I think by far my most outdated device is my NES Nintendo. Last night I was playing Dr. Mario and beating the pants off my husband.
I have a 20-year-old original Nintendo Game Boy. I got it when I was 7. And not only does it still function, it works perfectly. It's been dropped in the toilet twice. It's been dropped on concrete floors more than I can count. And the thing is still going. Still fun to play old games like Tetris.
And besides those video games, there were a lot of you who called in and wrote in echoing this listener's sentiments.
This is Carly from East Harlem. My still treasured but outdated device is my Sony Walkman. It has this bright yellow sporty plastic exterior that I really believed projected to everyone around me that I was some sort of elite athlete, even though at the time I was using it to practice my musical theater song.
And of course, radio listeners also love their radios.
This is Steve in Texas. I have a pair of 1930s vacuum tube radios, one with an LP player recorder. We used this growing up to play those cool Golden Book LPs.
Another listener from Arlington writes us, I have an old portable transistor radio that I carry around the house with me.
Scotland and Joe from Rob the People.
I love the crackle between stations and how sometimes it's hard to get the station that you want. I have all the latest devices, but I couldn't go a day without my transistor radio. It just makes me happy. And from Everett, Washington, we got this. My most outdated device is a digital clock radio alarm.
Then put your little hand in mine.
It's been waking me in the mornings with music from my whole adult life, but now it awakens me to the sweet voice of John Hockenberry and The Takeaway. Sweet, huh?
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much.
A huge number of you can't say goodbye to your record players. A listener from South Carolina writes, my father's old turntable is my oldest device, but I wouldn't call it outdated. It has great audio quality and a deliberately more involved listening experience. Of course, many of you out there just don't listen to old gadgets. You watch them.
Nelson Reyes. I'm calling from Miami. I have my old 27-inch television. It's 27 inches wide, and it's also 27 inches deep. But it still works like the first day I got it.
Well, for some of you, your old technology has nothing to do with entertainment at all.
This is Karen in Miami, Florida. My old technology is an IBM Selectric typewriter. It comes in handy when I want to neatly complete paper forms. It usually gets the job done, and then my handwriting skills are not an issue.
And maybe weirdest of all was the realization that a gadget less than a decade old can suddenly seem like ancient history. Here's a listener from Pittsburgh, writes us, my iPod is a 40-gig one with a hard drive and a black and white screen. I paid $400 for it in 2004. I keep it on a speaker dock in my office to play music during patient visits. One young man saw it and commented on my vintage iPod. Hey, it still works. Why would I want a new one?
Yes, I love technology.
And that is the sentiment that so many of you relate to us. My old gadget still works. Why get a new one? Tell us your oldest gadget at 8778-MY-TAKE. If you dial in on a rotary phone, you get extra points. You can get to us on Facebook.com/TheTakeaway. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
You know who that is. That's the Terminator, in that case from Terminator 2, fighting another killer robot. And the idea of killer robots is an old staple of American sci-fi. Go back to Gort in The Day the Earth Stood Still. Of course, you have the Terminator. The examples are dozens and dozens. You can name them for yourself. But recently, killer robots and the fight against them aren't the thing of sci-fi anymore. They've grown real and a lot more serious. Last month, the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots launched in London, and today a report calling for a global moratorium on lethal autonomous robotics will be presented to the UN Human Rights Council. Mark Bishop sits on the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. He's also a professor of cognitive computing at Goldsmiths University of London and chairs the Society for the Study of Artificial Intelligence and Simulation of Behavior. He joins us from London to explain the reality of killer robots and how to stop them. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
You sound all too real, and I'm happy for it. Mark, when people hear about killer robots, their mind is going to go to drones that are in the news so much. But drones aren't an example of killer robots. They have somebody on a joystick in Nevada or California driving it. That's not what you're talking about, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we're particularly concerned about fully autonomous systems where the human has been taken out of the control loop. What happens when you do that? You get a decrease in precision about what will happen to the weapon after it's been deployed, and potentially all sorts of unpleasant side effects that you haven't foreseen, such as unforeseen escalations of systems. So we're particularly concerned to try and ban fully autonomous weapon systems rather than the drone-type systems.
What are some examples of fully autonomous weapons that are already in use?
Well, the three fielder systems don't look particularly like the Terminator, the three ones that I can think of. And these all have an autonomous mode, but that mode can be switched on and off by a weapons officer. But once engaged, for example, you're probably aware of the Phalanx system, which is a close-in weapons system for defending ships against missiles. And it's, I believe, fielded on most, if not all, American Navy ships at the moment. And this is basically a very high-speed radar-controlled Gatling gun type device that operates at short range to automatically take out any incoming threats to the ship.
Well, that's one good example. And, of course, I know that you're prepared for this question, but when you sort of look at the development of weapons technology, Mark Bishop, one might say that a landmine is an unsophisticated unmanned weapon. It sits under the ground, it goes click, it blows up, sort of the same thing as the Phalanx in a way.
The difference being is that the Phalanx seeks out and destroys particular targets that are coming in, whereas usually landmines are relatively passive devices. They're not usually actively engaged in selecting targets and then tracking them, intercepting them in the way that a Phalanx system would be.
I understand the difference. So what is it that you're really afraid of with these autonomous systems? Is it not a sci-fi dystopia where they become self-aware? It must be something different.
There's sort of two ways of looking at this. There's the threat of the sci-fi dystopia threat that's made popular by films like Terminator, and that's kind of predicated on the notion that a robot can have some sort of goal-directed behavior. The robot might want to take over the world, for example, or destroy the last human. And the science behind that is at best tenuous, and at worst, there are many people in the world who think that sort of situation can never happen. Even if it could, we're looking a long way down the line for something like that, and that's really not what people are getting alarmed at the moment. We're looking at systems like Phalanx, like the Israeli Harpy system, which is a system that you can fire and forget, and that's designed to take out and destroy, for example, radar installations, or, for example, the CBU-97 intelligent cluster munition, which, once released, fires lots of submunitions which each track down particular radar profiles and seek to destroy them. Those are the sorts of devices we're interested in.
And mostly we're worried about a problem of escalation where as the technology escalates, so does the danger from the weapons. Thank you, Mark Bishop from the International Committee for Robotics Arms Control. There's a new autonomous robotics moratorium being put before the UN Human Rights Council. You're charging your battery, and now we're full of energy. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry. Well, last month in Boston, it saw one of the most extensive manhunts in that city's history, following, of course, the Marathon bombings. And within days of the attacks, two suspects were identified following an intense firefight with the police. One of the accused, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was killed, and the other suspect, his younger brother, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, was eventually captured. But just how did investigators crack this case? And there's a new NOVA documentary produced by our partner WGBH in Boston exploring the role of high-tech tools along with good, old-fashioned, solid police work. The film investigates the painstaking work of law enforcement officials, including Boston Police Superintendent Bill Evans, who had run in the Boston Marathon himself the very morning of the bombing. Evans finished the race and was later called back, this time to work at what had turned into a devastating crime scene. Listen.
I had just run down the street probably an hour and a half before this, and it was such a festive occasion. And now to look up the street and see, unfortunately, those young victims still laying on the street, and to see windows smashed, the barriers blown out into the street, it was sad, is what it was.
Miles O'Brien is the producer and director of NOVA's documentary Manhunt, The Boston Bombers. The film airs on PBS stations tonight. Hi, Miles.
Hi, Todd.
Great to talk to you again. Miles, Bill Evans is one of the main characters in your story, and the most interesting thing about him, among a lot of things, is that he is not Mr. Technology. He's not Mr. Gadget or Mr. Facial Recognition. He's good old-fashioned police work who's operating in a new world.
Yeah, as he told me, he's not a CSI guy. He likes the technology. That's fine by him. But in the end, when you look at how this investigation finally came to a conclusion, it took a lot of shoe leather, a lot of good police work by human beings in conjunction with some pretty amazing tools.
One of the most interesting and important parts is where you start the film, which is the explosives guys and the I guess maybe in Texas or somewhere in the West, in the desert, where they blow up a lot of things and study the marks on them. And this was indispensable in recovering the pieces of that pressure cooker bombs that were so important here.
Yes, Todd, about 1,500 of the first responders in Boston got their training from this place in New Mexico, New Mexico Tech, where they teach them how to, well, first and foremost, be careful when you approach a scene where there has been a bomb, because secondary explosions are, of course, a big concern. Take care of the injured, but also preserve the forensic evidence. The thing that I take away from that is so interesting is when you think of an explosion, you think, well, what sort of evidence could there be? It's been blown up. But each and every piece of those bombs, those pressure cookers, exist. If you look long enough, you can actually, like you would an airplane after a crash, rebuild that bomb and get a sense of what happened, how it was built, and potentially find some clues.
Well, let's hear from one of your experts who does that very thing and looks for the clues on those cookers. Listen.
The fact that they were two for two kind of indicates to me that it was a little bit more than luck. And the fact that they were so close together, you know, 10 seconds, 10 to 15 seconds away, is essentially simultaneous. To me, it indicates some level of sophistication.
Miles O'Brien, that's Van Romero. He's one of the world's leading experts on explosions, talking about how the way the explosions went off led him to think in a new way about who was building these bombs and how sophisticated they were.
Well, the pressure cooker bomb, Todd, is widely used as an instrument of terror all over the world. When he saw the explosion at Boston, Van Romero, he saw that white smoke, and he immediately, as an expert, said, oh, that's black powder, that's gunpowder. And his next reaction was, oh, there's probably a pipe bomb, because pipe bombs are much more commonly used here in the U.S. But then he looked at the debris pattern, the number of windows broken, and he said, you know, this is much bigger than a pipe bomb. And that's what led him to a hunch that it was a pressure cooker bomb. Not long thereafter, technicians and forensics investigators found a lid of a pressure cooker on the roof of a six-story hotel on Boylston Street, and that confirmed his hunch.
Miles O'Brien, what was interesting to me is that investigators in Boston don't have the ability to watch at one time hundreds or thousands of street cameras to try to get these composite views. They had to do something a lot more sort of mundane to get good images of the crime. But you visited New York, here in New York, where police do have the ability to watch thousands and thousands and thousands of cameras all at once and use a lot of technology to basically watch us all the time. And I found that chilling.
Yes, it's a little bit creepy, isn't it, Todd?
It's more than a little bit creepy. And it's troubling, to be honest with you.
Well, there's a lot of things we need to be discussing about this, because we have created this, sort of big brother state in the wake of 9/11. And it does, in the end, help us become more secure. But we're headed down a slippery slope where we're just watching everyone all the time. And that's a scary thing. When you go to the Domain Awareness Command Center at the foot of Broadway in New York, and you look at 4,000 cameras feeding in there, and the fact that they scan every driver's license plate that comes into the lower part of Manhattan every day, the fact that they have the ability to punch in, show me all the red shirts near the New York Stock Exchange, and they come up within seconds, and you can see it live. It's astounding, actually. And I think it's, you know, this is where policing is headed. This is where our country is headed. We've created this infrastructure where we're surveilling each other. And I think it's time we have a discussion about where we're headed with all this.
And Miles, when you talk about technology here, another aspect of this took place on the internet with regular people and social media websites like Reddit.com, where users kind of took it upon themselves to try to suss out the perpetrators and wound up identifying the wrong people. It all went wrong, correct?
In a very ugly way. You know, we talk about the wisdom of the crowds a lot. Sometimes it's just the crowds. And sometimes the crowds can turn into a witch hunt very quickly. And that's what we saw. And, we talk about a 24-hour news cycle. These days, it's about a 24-second news cycle. And when things go wrong and things go off the rail, it happens a lot faster, a lot quicker, and has bigger consequences than ever before.
Were there any lessons learned? I mean, there's really doesn't seem like there's any way to prevent social websites like that from getting on the case, even if they're doing it in a harmful way.
We can't control the internet. We just have to make people realize that doing this has real-world consequences, and people could have gotten hurt.
Well, there's lots of old-world policing. There's lots of new-world technology involved in Manhunt, the Boston bombers. It all combines into one brew that helped investigators in Boston, both federal, state, and local, catch the bombers relatively quickly. But if you watch the documentary, you'll realize that a lot of the technology in use, even facial recognition, isn't quite as good as we think it is. And Miles O'Brien, you helped us understand that in Manhunt, the Boston bombers. Thanks, Miles.
You're welcome, Todd.
It's on PBS Tonight. Check your local listings. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, given all that we've heard over the last couple of months and years, it's looking increasingly likely that the rules regarding how the military investigates claims of sexual abuse are going to change. But a similar story of abuse within another American institution is getting a lot less play in the news, but it really does bear a close listen. Last week, Rick Curl, a former USA swimming coach, was convicted and sentenced for 7 years for sexually abusing Kelly Curran. She was one of his swimmers. Curran alleges that officials within USA Swimming knew about the abuse and did nothing. Sound familiar? She's calling for them to be fired. Kelly Curran is not the only person alleging that a culture of sexual abuse in USA Swimming is a reality. Catherine Starr is an Olympic swimmer who competed in the LA and Seoul Games. She founded the Safe for Athletes organization in 2011 and spoke with me a little earlier.
I've gone through life. I'm 30 years removed from my sexual abuse and from my coach who did go to prison. And the pain and the severity that I have gone through my entire life was so significant that I felt that I couldn't let another child walk through life like I have.
And you, like Kelly Curran, allege that it's not just abuse that she experienced or abuse that you experienced as individuals, but this is pervasive. I mean, that's quite the charge.
I swam at the University of Texas with Kelly, and from since I've started Safe for Athletes, I've always known about Kelly since I was teammates with her. That was common knowledge throughout our swim program, as well as actually throughout USA Swimming. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But there's a very elite team. Four of about 20 swimmers were sexually abused by their youth coaches, myself being one, Kelly being the other. So that's a very small group of very elite swimmers to have experienced and just kind of tell you the depth of the problem that has been happening over the decades.
Now, Rick Curl, the former USA Swimming coach that we just mentioned, was sentenced, went to prison for 7 years. But one of your points here is that there hasn't been accountability across the organization. And I want you to talk about that a little bit, about accountability. We have a statement from Chuck Wallace, who's executive director. I'll bring that in a moment. But what's your view on the level of accountability or lack thereof?
Well, the problem is, I mean, I could name for you right now four coaches that have produced Olympians and in some cases in the Hall of Fame that have allegations towards them. And not one of them over the years has been investigated. And actually, I brought up to Susan Wessner in regards to an allegation, several allegations that has come up against Mitch Ivey. And ESPN even did a story way back in the 90s and was fired from University of Florida for it and was informed that, well, he's on a list. So if he applies, you know, they would do something. Meanwhile, he's actively attached to the Swimming Coaches Association and working and consulting in that environment. So, you know, the lack of accountability over the years has been rampant, and they haven't taken this issue seriously and taken every effort to protect young swimmers.
Catherine Starr, let me read a statement that we got from USA Swimming Executive Director Chuck Wilgus. We asked him for a statement and we received this. We remain committed to responsibly and diligently addressing any issues we have within our organization, and I'm proud of the good work our Safe Sport program has done since inception in 2010. Since that time, 36 members have been sanctioned for code of conduct violations, 30 of whom have been banned for life. We continue to take action to remove individuals from our sport that should not be part of our member organization. That's a statement from USA Swimming Executive Director Chuck Wilgus. So that's his case, Catherine Starr, for accountability. 36 members sanctioned, 30 who have been banned for life.
So, there's many more of our elite coaches who we haven't taken responsibility for, as I mentioned, for others that I could name those for you with all those allegations, that they haven't done enough. And actually, the only way you're going to get banned, and the person who oversees that ban, is a swimmer by the name of Jill Johnson Chasen, who's married to her swim coach, who makes a determination on whether a coach has been engaged inappropriately with another athlete. So it's a very incestuous within the swimming community, even with determining who gets banned. Prior to the Safe Sport program, issues came up repeatedly, especially in the case of Kelly and Rick Curl. And if you look at one of the allegations that Kelly has asked is about Mark Schubert, whom I swam with Kelly at Texas and became knowledge of. And if you look at Scott Reed actually documented his efforts where he did go to Chuck Wilgus over the course of time. And he's on three different occasions while Rick Curl remained coming into headquarters in Colorado Springs and participating actively while everybody sort of turned the other way. That's not leadership.
And Catherine Starr, I mean, one cannot escape the parallels between the things that you're describing, at least, and what we know happened at Penn State with Jerry Sandusky and the coaches there. It smacks to me of some of the complaints about sexual assault in the military, where when people complain, they wind up sort of complaining to a hierarchy that's not necessarily invested in solving the problem. I don't know if there's a direct comparison between swimming and the military, but some of these comparisons are inescapable. And I wonder if it's the fact that a lot of people aren't aware of swimming, except every 4 years during the Olympics, maybe, that helps this sort of stay in the shadows. I don't know.
Well, that certainly could be the case. I mean, the commerciality of the sport, which is getting a lot more commercial with, you know, money and investments and sponsorship and the high profile of Michael Phelps. I mean, that certainly keeps the sport a little bit more engaging throughout the, you know, in between the 4 years. But it's definitely like Penn State. It's definitely like the military. I have spoken to numerous parents, and the parents come to me when all the doors have been shut and they're trying to get justice for their child. And that's not an isolated incident. That's the norm. And then the other issue here is the type of relationship that female athletes, I actually refer to this as athlete domestic violence, and the fact that they get into a sexual engagement with their coach. And often cases with the child even being 15, 16, the parents turn a blind eye to this. And This is very pervasive in sports and very pervasive extremely in swimming itself.
Catherine Starr, Olympic swimmer and founder and president of Safe for Athletes, swam with Kelly Curran at the University of Texas. Now, one of Kelly Curran's coaches, Rick Curl, former USA swimming coach, convicted and sentenced for 7 years for sexually abusing Kelly Curran. Catherine Starr is now speaking out. Catherine, we thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
We did ask USA Swimming for an interview. A link to their full statement can be found on the website at thetakeaway.org. Our thanks again to Catherine Starr, Olympic swimmer and founder of Safe for Athletes. A final word now for the time being on your oldest and fondest gadgets from JP in Asbury Park in New Jersey. I have one of the first smartphones released with a Windows operating system to compete with the Palm Pilot. Everybody made fun of me because it was so big compared to the phones of the day, which were smaller flip phones. Ironically now, everyone's smartphones today, though thinner, are the same size as my thick Windows phone. And I would say to you, JP, that being a bit of a Luddite when it comes to technology is a lot sweeter when there's victory at the end, isn't it? You can find us online at thetakeaway.org. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Of course, you can tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Next time, join me here in New York and John Hockenberry in Mexico City. Together, this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.